Welcome to a Juno Afternoon on Monday, October 6, 2014. Scott Burton, your host today. Melani Shivens will be here to highlight the results of a recent survey about the impact of arts in Southeast Alaska. We'll get the details about the UAS One Campus One Book Program from English professor Richard Simpson. NAMI's Dove Gartenberg will be here to give us details about this Saturday's 5K walk run. We'll learn about painting classes from Louise Miller and Jessica Snyder, plus Writer's Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more right here on a Juno Afternoon.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Protests were held across Canada over the weekend. Many called for a national investigation into cases of missing and murdered women. Dan Karpinchuk reports.
That I didn't have to feel all this pain all the time for my friends. That we didn't have to come here and have a vigil or write a list of names of your friends that are missing or murdered.
Connie Gray Eyes was one of hundreds of people across the country to voice their frustration with the Canadian government's continued refusal to hold a public inquiry on the issue. Gray Eyes, a Cree from Alberta, was among the crowd of protesters in Ottawa who gathered on the steps of the Canadian Parliament. In attendance were also opposition lawmakers and family members of murdered or missing Aboriginal women and girls. Gray Eyes says these protests should not be necessary.
Why do we have to come here and beg for you to notice us and to see us as people?
Organizers say people have come together across the country demanding action from the federal government of Prime Minister Stephen Harper. But Harper continues to reject calls for an inquiry, saying his government will treat the issue as a crime, not as a sociological phenomenon. Other protests closed two stretches of highways in southern Ontario. This is the ninth year that a National Day of Vigils has been organized in Canada. When it began in 2006, 11 vigils were held. This weekend, people gathered at more than 200 locations across the country. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
An archaeological dig in southwest Alaska contributed the largest set of genetic samples to a DNA study released this summer in the journal Science. KYUK's Daisha Eaton has more.
The project, called Nunatlik, meaning Old Village, is located 5 miles outside Quinnahock. Dr. Rick Connect is an archaeologist with the University of Aberdeen in Scotland who manages the dig. He says permafrost at the ancient Yupik village of Akralik preserved artifacts up to 700 years old made of wood and leather that normally would have disintegrated, and hundreds of hair samples.
We contributed about 33 hair samples to the study. And I think that's more than any of the sites were able to produce, and just because of the extraordinary preservation here.
The study, led by a group of Danish researchers, revealed that the modern Inuit people, including those in Alaska, are descended from the Tule, who developed around 700 years ago, replacing an earlier population, the Paleo-Eskimos. The genetic evidence shows there was very little interbreeding and that the Tule are the ancestors of the Yupik and Inupiat people living on Alaska's west coast today.
We don't know, the origins of that, what we call the Tule population or the Neo-Eskimos, but we do know that both in the archaeological evidence, both the artifacts and the genetics look very much alike, surprisingly so, on the two ends of the Arctic, which is the largest indigenous territory of any group in the world.
Warren Jones is president of the Village Corporation in Quinnahock, Connectuck Incorporated. Jones says the corporation is interested in comparing the DNA of the ancient people of Akralik with the modern residents of Quinnahock.
We might get to see who was related to the people of Akralik. So that's pretty cool.
Jones says the corporation in Quinnahock eventually wants to develop ecotourism around the archaeological site, but rapid erosion at the site has made getting artifacts out a priority. In Bethel, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Our staff at National Native News is saddened by the death of longtime contributor Mike Simonson. He was a reporter at Wisconsin Public Radio for more than two decades with a passion for radio and covering Indian country issues. Mike contributed many tribal environmental stories, most recently looking at climate change on wild rice harvests. Mike, your stories and friendship will be missed. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation, and by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. Science, technology, engineering, and math students thrive at New Mexico Tech. Personalized instruction, rigorous curricula, undergrad research opportunities. New Mexico Tech, where the smart kids go. Info in Winds of Change magazine or visit nmt.edu. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And you're listening to a Juno Afternoon on Monday, October 6, 2014. Scott Burton, your Monday host, in with you. And now in the studio is Melanie Shivens, Director of Raincoast Data. Thanks for coming in, Melanie. It is nice to have you. So you recently conducted a data to quantify the impact of arts on Southeast Alaska.
Well, that's right. Actually, Southeast Conference hired Raincoast Data. Southeast Conference wanted to commission this study because, you know, when we look at all these different components of the Southeast Alaska economy, and some things kind of fall out of the normal data sets, and art is one of those sectors that really isn't, you can't measure it using the normal wage and labor data just because of how it's set up.
Okay.
And so Southeast Conference wanted once and for all to get a sense of how important the arts actually was to the regional economy.
Sounds good. And real quick, Southeast Conference, can you describe some of the folks on there?
Sure. So Southeast Conference is the regional economic entity of Southeast Alaska. It was created 55 years ago to set up the ferry system, to advocate for the ferry system. And it's a group of people from communities all across the region that decided to stay together to advocate for concerns that are focused on the region itself and on any specific community.
Sounds good. And so they came to you and Raincoast Data, and they thought you'd be the right person to reach out and talk to artists and talk to other folks in the economy here and figure out what was going on. So what did you find?
Well, I think, you know, the real question that I think a lot of people had is art different here? Is something special going on here when it comes to art and artists?
Right.
And so the first real answer to that is yes, arts is special here. We found that there's three times as many artists sort of per capita or per job. The saturation of artists is three times larger here than sort of the normal U.S. population as a whole. And so we definitely have a special art scene going.
Yeah. And I saw an interesting question that Shelley Wright, the executive director of the Southeast Conference, asked. She said, do we have arts because we have a good economy? Or do we have a good economy because we have great arts? And she was saying that's a very difficult question to answer.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think one thing that we really saw from the types of data that we were able to generate and the types of responses that we're able to get is that, you know, the strong Southeast Alaska art sector is an economic asset that stimulates business activity. It generates tourism revenue. It attracts and retains a high-quality workforce and population here. People come to Southeast Alaska because of the art scene. That's one thing that we heard of time and time again. You know, we are a recreation mecca. People come for our outdoor scene, but people also come to live here because of our art scene.
Absolutely. Go for a hike, and when you come down that night, you want to go to a gallery or a movie or a performance or a concert, right? I think a lot of us maybe have sensed that we have a vibrant arts community here in Juneau. I know that's one of the reasons I love living here, but it's nice to have these numbers attached to it and see some of these pie charts and graphs. If somebody wants to see these visuals, this is a really nice presentation.
Mm-hmm.
Where can somebody go to see these online? Or?
Well, sure. I have a couple answers to that. One is we're going to be doing the full PowerPoint presentation, the full presentation on the data at the JAC on Tuesday, October 14th at 5 p.m.
All right.
So if anyone wants to come and see the whole presentation and ask questions and sort of get the detailed analysis, they're welcome to come. Again, that's Tuesday, October 14th at 5 p.m. at the JAC. The document itself is at the Southeast Conference office and their address is 612 West Willoughby Avenue. So, you know, they've printed several hundred copies. They're happy to hand them out if you want your own glossy version. It's 12 pages long. It looks beautiful. So get a copy, or just go online, and you can go to seconference.org is their website, or my website is raincoastdata.com, okay. And you can find it there as well.
Sounds good. And Melani, tell me a little bit about your methodology. How did you put this all together?
Well, I'm completely addicted to data and to Southeast Alaska data specifically. And, you know, I originally got this job and kind of looked and realized that there was no data sets to quantify art. And so what we decided to do was launch this very ambitious art survey. It had a lot of questions. They were detailed financial questions. And our goal was to get independent artists and art organizations to fill out this sort of detailed financial questionnaire, and I was a little nervous that we would get people to respond. I had this number in my head that we needed to at least get 150 responses for the data to be viable, and you know, we actually got more than 600 independent artists and art organizations from across the region to take the survey. And I think in a way that's almost a finding in itself, just the passion that the arts community has, and these are people who are paid for the artwork to get out and stand up and be counted and to be sort of considered among the larger economic regional sectors.
Sure. And as you were gathering this data and communicating with artists and reading over these surveys, what surprised you most? What do you enjoy most about it? Were there any notable answers that stick in your head?
Well, sure. Let me just go through some of the top line answers before I go into kind of the, you know, so just for starters, if you look at dollars spent by artists, art organizations, and audience members last year, the art is responsible for about $60 million worth of spending in our region, which I thought that was a pretty large amount of spending to happen in Southeast Alaska. And, you know, we also measured 2,340 artists with earnings from arts in 2013 in Southeast Alaska. Artists themselves earned approximately $30 million last year. And one of the things that we found is that, you know, art is not really the main revenue stream for a lot of people, especially when we were looking at independent artists. Mm-hmm. Only 9% of our independent artists relied on art for all of their income stream, and the other 91% used it to supplement their income. But it turns out that it's a really important source of supplemental income for artists across the region.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see. And before we were talking a little bit, Melani, about just sort of how it mixes in macroeconomically, I guess, with this region. Say compared to tourism, off the top of your head, do you happen to know how it compares to that, or government, or other?
Sure. And so what I did is I looked at the data that we generated from in the art survey and tried to compare it to see what industries it was most comparable to. Mm-hmm. And so to put it into context for a second, in terms of workforce earnings, the art sector is nearly twice the size of the regional timber industry. And in terms of actual number of employees, in terms of if you compare it to the wage and labor economy, in terms of number of employees, it's about the same size as our financial services sector.
Interesting.
And so obviously that's the earnings for that sector aren't the same, but it really allows you to see how it compares across a couple of those spectrums.
All right, Melani. It's been great talking to you, and I highly recommend that our listeners, if you're into the arts, take a look at some of the stuff that Melani's put together. You can do that on October 14th at 5 p.m. Over at the Jack. Melani, is there anything else you'd like to add, something we haven't covered?
Well, there's a lot we haven't covered.
I know, right?
But one of the things that I found really fun is our very last question was not a detailed financial question. It was an open-ended question.
Uh-huh.
And so we asked artists, you know, is there anything else? Why are arts important to the region? Why are arts important to you? And we got some incredible answers. And so I didn't know what to do with that. We have our report is a 12-page sort of large overview, high-level overview. And so the answers were so great that we put them in an appendix, and so that's also online at the Southeast Conference website. It's 60 pages of just wonderful answers of why artists are here in Southeast Alaska and doing art in the region.
Okay, so I definitely go and check those out as well, or go see this presentation on Tuesday, October 14th, 5 p.m., right across the street here at the Jack, right?
Right across the street at the Jack.
Well, sounds good. I was trying to think. I should probably play a Southeast Alaskan artist at the end of our interview.
That'd be perfect.
And actually, he's since left us, but one of the reasons I enjoy living in Southeast and one of the great artists of this region, Mr. Buddy Tabor. Here's one of his numbers.
You could drive by here, you could miss this place. It's always come down to just a little simple fate. Her heart was red earth, her house was red stone. I can still feel her spirit rattle down in my bones. Her skin, it was brown, her eyes like the night. Her hair was like ravens in the midair of flight. Black wings that danced with rhythm and rhyme, like the jingle you get out of quarters and dimes. There's thistles and thorns, there's stickers and briars, there's poets, thieves and cheaters and liars. There's horses for riding, fences to mend, and I doubt if I'll ever get back here again. She was a moment of grace for this poor wretched fool, but my heart was so hardened, I was so cruel. Now loneliness, my house guest, I'll never be free. You eat everything and then refuse to leave. There's thistles and thorns, there's stickers and briars, there's poets and thieves and cheaters and liars. There's horses for riding, fences to mend, and I doubt if I'll ever get back here again. Now at one morning's wake, that it was bare, I looked all around, but she just was not there. Like a dream that evaporates up with the sun, the love I once knew it was done. There's thistles and thorns, there's stickers and briars, there's poets, thieves and cheaters and liars. There's horses for riding, fences to mend, and I doubt if I'll ever get back here again. Now the night is so long and my bed is so cold, and my arms seem so useless when there's no one to hold. Young men, don't you do the things that I did, or your heart will be empty like the howl of the wind. You know I made her cry, you know I caused her pain. I'm a lonely old man who walks with a cane. There's horses for riding, fences to mend, and I doubt if I'll ever get back here again. No, I doubt if I'll ever get back here again.
A diamond is one of the most precious gems on earth, its facets reflecting the colors of the rainbow. And just like a diamond, KRNN is a multifaceted jewel reflecting the colors of our community in the form of music. From classical to folk, jazz to rock, world music to the blues, KRNN is the epitome of eclecticity. If you'd prefer a roadmap, check out our website at krnn.org for a detailed look at our program schedule, and tune in to 102.7 FM. You'll be glad you did.
You're listening to A Juno Afternoon on Monday, October 6th, 2014. Scott Burton with you today. And now in the studio is Professor Richard Simpson, and we'll be talking about the UAS One Campus One book program a little bit, and specifically about a film screening, Ketchikan, A Fish Story. and also about Katie Rogers. So welcome to the show, Richard.
Hello, Scott. It's great to be here.
Yeah. So you're a new English professor out at the U, right?
Yes, I am.
Well, welcome to Juneau. How's it treating you so
Thank
far?
Thank you very much. Absolutely wonderful. Yeah. I love it. Yes.
Where did you come from?
From Miami, Florida.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Little different, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. Not too far away.
All right. So what are you teaching at the university?
I'm teaching courses in eco-criticism.
Okay.
As well as composition, as well as geography.
Okay. All right. Well, it's nice to have you here. Let's see. So, the One Campus, One Book program, why don't we start by just outlining that a little bit for our listeners if they're not familiar?
Sure. So, that's a program. It's been around campus for a few years, and the idea is to have this unification amongst the incoming freshmen, that they have a shared experience of reading a piece of literature that has been decided by a committee of students and faculty the year before. And so this year, it is John Steinbeck's The Log from the Sea of Cortez, which is an interesting sort of collaboration between Ed Ricketts, a marine biologist, and John Steinbeck, this writer. So you have this sort of collaboration of a scientist working together with a fiction writer, and they put together this book about the coast of California, and it turns out to be one of the important historical documents on the Sea of Cortez itself. So it's an interesting sort of interdisciplinary book, as well as sort of a piece of travel writing that's really well known.
Absolutely. So I'm teaching English 111 on Tuesday nights out at the U, and we're reading the class as part of the whole program.
Excellent.
We're reading the book as part of the whole program, and it's really enjoyable. We were mentioning, you know, just before the show how it mixes science and literature. It's describing science from an artist's point of view. So we've really enjoyed reading it aloud in class. It's a fun read.
That's great to hear. Yeah, we're reading it in my eco-criticism course as well in a couple of weeks, so I'm looking forward to that too. Yeah.
And just Steinbeck, what a master writer. I had this moment the other day when I was reading it, and I went back and I read the sentence a couple of times, and I'm a writer too, and I'm like, it was one of those moments where you almost just want to stop what you do because what they do is so good.
Mm. Yes, yes.
Like, I don't know if I could ever come up with something that artful. It was just brilliant.
You can, Scott. Keep at it. You'll be there.
Thanks, Richard. All right. So as part of this program, which I like so much, the One Book, One Campus program, is that you do attach all these programs to it to sort of augment it and make it sort of come to life a bit. And so that starts tonight. Well, I wouldn't say start, but continues tonight. What do you got going on?
That's absolutely right. So at 7 o'clock tonight at the UAS Rec Center, they'll be screening a documentary called Ketchikan, A Fish Story. And this is a documentary that was made in 2009, put together by the Ketchikan business community as a way to sort of to advertise for the city of Ketchikan for those who are on the cruise ships. So this DVD is shown in the cruise ships to sort of give a sense of the unique community of Ketchikan and the importance that nature and specifically that fish plays in the lives of the people who live there and how this is very different from other communities.
Yeah, and I happen to see and it's very people-centric. You sort of learn the stories of a handful of individuals, and it shows fishing through the community's eyes, I guess. So
that's right, yeah. I was also sort of amazed by the myriad different forms of fishing there.
Mm-hmm.
It goes into gill netting, trawling, hand trawling, power trawling, as well as sort of native forms of halibut fishing. And so they talk a little bit about different forms of collecting fish and how important it is to the community there.
All right. So you said that's tonight at the Rec Center. Is that correct?
That's right. That's tonight at 7 o'clock.
Okay.
And then on Thursday, Katie Roger is coming from UC Davis. She's in the English department there, and she's going to be giving a talk on the One Campus, One Book selection this year. And her talk will be called Discovering Science and Finding the Story. But that talk is on Friday.
Evening at Egan, right?
That's right.
Is she like a Steinbeck scholar, maybe?
She is. This is sort of a major part of her research, but in general she works on the relationship between science writing and fiction writing as
okay.
well. But we'll be having a reception for her, and everybody's invited to come this Thursday from 3 o'clock to 5 p.m. at the Egan Building on campus, and there'll be some food there, too.
Sounds good. If any of my students happen to be listening, all of this is extra credit opportunities. You should go. It'll be fun. And at the reception, probably some food, right?
Absolutely.
Yep. Tell that
probably
to freshmen.
Some fish.
They
yeah.
might show.
That's right.
Free food. All right, Richard, what else? Anything else you want to share with us about events and such? Or
Saturday, they're actually showing the film Cannery Row at the Douglas Public Library at 2 o'clock, which is good to know about. And, no, that's everything for this week, for sure.
Sounds good. Well, Professor Richard Simpson, welcome to Juneau. Thanks for coming on the show today and telling us about all these events. Again, Thursday from 3 to 5, reception for Katie Rogers. Backing up tonight, Ketchikan, a fish story at the Rec Center. What time again?
7 p.m.
7 p.m. Thursday from 3 to 5 is the reception for Katie. What time and where was that one again?
That's in the Egan Building in the Glacier Room.
Okay, Glacier Room. And then Friday night is evening at Egan, of course, and that's with Katie Rogers. And then Saturday is showing of Cannery Row at the Douglas Library at what time?
2 p.m.
2 p.m. Sounds good. Anything else you want to add?
Nope, that's everything. Thanks.
All right, Richard, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday, the 6th of October, 2014. It's German-American Day today. It was on this date in 1683. William Penn brought the first group of German settlers to America. To Pennsylvania, 13 of them from the lower Rhine Valley, most of them Quakers or Mennonites. They came to Pennsylvania and founded the settlement Germantown. It was on this date, 1945, a Greek tavern owner in Chicago named William Cyanus was thrown out of Wrigley Field in Chicago for trying to bring a goat to a game. It was the World Series, and the Chicago Cubs were up 2-1 over the Detroit Tigers. Cyanus had a tavern across the street from the ballpark. He thought the goat would bring the team good luck, so he bought 2 tickets, one for him, one for the goat, whose name was Murphy. They wouldn't let him into the ballpark because they said the goat stinks, and according to legend, William Cyanus then cursed the team. The Cubs went on to lose the next 3 games, and they have not appeared in a World Series ever since. It was on this date, 2007, that Jason Lewis and the Expedition 360 team completed the first entirely human-powered trip around the world, traveling on human power alone, no help from motors, animals, or even sails to capture the wind. They didn't do it all at once. It took them, in fact, more than 13 years to accomplish this. Set off from Greenwich, England, July 12, 1994, pedaled a boat across the English Channel, bicycled through France, Spain, and Portugal, then crossed the Atlantic Ocean, which took 111 days, landed in Miami, biked and skated across the continental United States. Jason Lewis had to stop and earn money at various times, worked at cattle ranches, funeral homes. About a year into the expedition, he was rollerblading on a Colorado road when he was run over by a drunk driver, both of his legs broken, one almost amputated, spent 6 weeks in the hospital, 9 months recovering before he could resume his trip around the world. Many mishaps. He was arrested in Egypt as a suspected spy, came down with malaria, had 2 hernia operations, was robbed once. And finally, on this day, in 2007, he returned to Greenwich. Here's a poem for today by John Ashbery, entitled Composition. We used to call it the boob tube, but I guess they don't use tubes anymore. Whatever, it serves a small purpose after waking and before falling asleep. Today's news. But is there such a thing as news or even oral history? Yes, when you want to go back after a while and appraise the accumulation of leaves, say in a sandbox, the rest is rented depression, available only in season, and the season is always next month, a pure but troubled time. That's why I don't go out much, though staying at home never seemed much of an option. And speaking of nutty concepts, surely home is way up there on the list. I feel more certain about now and then, because they are close to me, like lovers, though apparently not in love with me, as I am with them. I like to call to them, and sometimes they reply out of the deep business of some dream. A poem entitled Composition by John Ashbery from Where Shall I Wander, published by Echo Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Arizona State University, with more than 70 campus degrees now available 100% online at online.asu.edu, and by Lumosity.com, a brain training program designed by neuroscientists that's been used by 50 million people worldwide. More at Lumosity.com. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Join NAMI Juno for the Juno Extra Tough 5K Walk Run to benefit education, support, and advocacy for persons and families living with mental illness. The Extra Tough 5K Walk Run takes place on Saturday, October 11th at 1 p.m. beginning at the Riverbend Covered Play Area. Pre-register at local gyms, JAHC, NAO, Foggy Mountain, online at namijuno.org, or on the day of the event. This message is brought to you by NAMI Juno.
And with me now in the studio on a Juno afternoon on Monday, October 6, 2014, is Rabbi Dov Gartenberg. Welcome, sir, to the show today.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And we're going to be talking about that walk here in a minute.
I'm already in my extra tufts.
You ready?
Sure.
All right. So we're going to get to that in a minute. That's going to be this Saturday out at the Brotherhood Trail. But before that, why don't you tell us a little bit about NAMI and Juno NAMI and
sure.
your association with all of them.
Sure. NAMI means the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We're a national organization with over 1,000 affiliates across the United States. And, of course, we are the Juno and Southeast affiliate. And we have a common purpose with all our affiliates and across the country, and that is to support, educate, and provide advocacy, and also public awareness about mental illness and those who live with mental illness and their families. So we want to provide hope and support. And what's really unique about NAMI in the world of mental health is that we're a peer-driven organization. So everything we do is people who have been through it, like our teachers for our courses or our support groups are led by people who themselves are either family members or people living with mental illness. So it's that's the niche we have, but it's very important because we link providers, mental health clinicians, and also counselors, social workers, policymakers to deal with the issues of mental health.
Well, that's an interesting perspective, too. I know last time you were on the show, you and I spoke, you have a relative who has a mental illness.
Right.
And so you, as a person who knows an individual with a mental illness, you are able to communicate about this organization and the severity of this problem.
Right.
From
right.
the heart, from experience.
Yes. As I mentioned then, I have a son who lives with mental illness and he lives with bipolar. He's high functioning. And so each story is different. Each situation is different. But we do see in our experience with NAMI is that the impacts are often the same, and the process of people going through and dealing with it and living with it day by day are actually a lot of commonalities. So we bring people together, and sharing our stories, we really build solidarity and fellowship.
Okay. And just thinking of it at a national level, or I guess it would be worldwide, I read a statistic that it's 1 in 4 adults that suffers?
Mental illness, very pervasive. It's 1 in 4 in the United States, probably. You know, it's not it's an equal opportunity employer, as it were. Mm-hmm. Also, for instance, disability, it's the greatest cause of disability in the United States.
Interesting.
There are so many interesting statistics to go through, but and you can find that at NAMI.org at the website, just to get the general statistical view. And it's also one of the most mysterious illnesses, because unlike, say, cancer or heart disease, where there are indicators, or you can validate it, as physicians say, it's hard, you know, when we diagnose for mental illness, it's not an exact science.
Sure.
We're learning more about the brain, and it's a very exciting time in terms of possibilities of finding cures, but it's a ways off. We know more than we did before.
Okay. And the reason that you were here a couple weeks ago and you're back today is this is all part of National Mental Illness Awareness Week.
That's right. So
you started on Sunday, right, with the bike race.
Yeah, we had a bike race, or at least indoor bike race, on Sunday. And on Tuesday night, we have a presentation by Margie Thompson, Jason Laskelius, on what is mental health first aid, which is this real burgeoning movement across the country to help people understand mental health first aid, just like we understand first aid, right?
Sure.
It's something that it's a skill that a lot of us we should have. So helping someone who may be suicidal or who's experiencing severe depression, learning how to do those things, even when not family members, is very important. It might save a life.
Yeah. Can you give us an example of what a situation like that might look like, performing first aid on a...
Well, I'll give you an example of just recently someone who called, who runs a business here and had an employee who was severely depressed.
Mm.
And didn't know really what to do. And so she was seeking guidance on how she could learn more and what sorts of things she could be proactive about in helping this employee.
Oh, interesting.
It doesn't just happen to family members. You can see it in all sorts of different situations.
Sure. And second aid might be contacting NAMI. But first aid could do right there.
Right. I mean, there's a lot of different, you know, depending on how close you are to a person. NAMI certainly is really, really helpful for people living with mental illness, for families, for people who are public advocates, providers. A lot of people who are see mental illness fairly frequently. But mental health first aid is really for everybody, and
okay.
It's something that we hope everyone will eventually know about.
So that's tomorrow night at the hospital, right?
Right, Bartlett.
And it's free?
It's free, 5:15 at the administration building there. There'll be signs.
Okay, so learn about first aid there. And then on Saturday.
And then we're going to walk, rain or shine, starting at the River Bend school covered playground, where you can register if you don't register this week. And there'll be an opportunity to run if you're a runner, and there'll be opportunity to walk if you prefer to walk. You don't have to wear extra tough, so let's call it an extra tough NAMI walk. And NAMI walks, by the way, is sort of the brand. NAMI has walks all over the country, often very big walks in major cities.
Mm-hmm.
And this is our regionally adjusted NAMI walk with the extra tough symbol, obviously a Southeast symbol.
Oh,
but we're raising money to support NAMI. We do a lot of training of peer volunteers, and the money that we raise helps with that and helps expand our programs to reach families and individuals who are living with mental illness.
And can you describe the route for us of the walk?
It will start at River Bend, and we'll walk a Brotherhood Trail. The run will also follow that. Of course, the runners will finish first.
Mm-hmm.
But there are also going to be lots of door prizes. People, you know, when they sign up, they come back from their walk or run, there may be a door prize waiting for you. So including tram tickets and all sorts of wonderful items.
And this starts at 1 o'clock on Saturday.
It's 1 o'clock on Saturday. We'll have a brief opening ceremony. There'll be booths there for people to register. You also can buy items if you'd like. There'll be also a NAMI booth. And also some of the other really wonderful organizations that are involved in mental health will be there as well. I know that Catholic Community Services will be there, and I believe JAMI will be there. Some other organizations will have booths. So it'll be fun, and it'll be just a wonderfully positive and event that I think we'll see a lot of people in the community.
Not only is it a beautiful place to walk, you can't lose that, but walking with fellow community members for a good cause, maybe meet somebody new, come up with solutions. It's a great thing, I think, that NAMI gets behind is walking.
Sure, and I think we're one of the few groups now that does it in the fall, which is a testimony to our belief in the toughness
of
the
leaves,
Juneau people.
crispness in the air, maybe.
Oh, the air's going to be great. We don't know whether there'll be moisture or be drier, but we go now. Views of glacier. It'll be really, really nice. It'll be nice by the river. And, it'll be fun. A really fun event.
I bet it will be. And if somebody wants more information, they can go to namijuno.org, right?
Yes, they can go there. They can download the registration form. And by tonight, we will have the credit card thing in place. We're working on that to make sure it's just as easy as possible for you to sign up or donate. And if, worst comes to worst, you don't get around to it, just show up, come a little before one, so you can, certainly if you're a runner, because we want you to be ready to run the run, but come early and sign up, and you'll have a great time.
All right. NAMI's Executive Director, Dove Gartenberg, thank you so much for your time today. Anything else?
Thank you,
Scott. Are we missing anything?
Well, just check out our website. There's a lot of programs starting, too, including the family-to-family classes for family members who have a loved one who they're caring for who's living with a mental illness. That's going to start soon. And there's just a lot of things going on. You'll find that out at namijuno.org. And I think you might find something that will be very meaningful for you.
Great. There. Well, thanks for all that you do.
Thank you.
This is Bird Note. The sight of a heron standing in a marsh, stabbing at prey in the shallows, is familiar in many places. But a few heron species shun the daylight to hunt their prey by night. One of these nocturnal specialists, the black-crowned night heron, is found across much of the U.S. It also inhabits all the continents except Australia and Antarctica. It's even found in island groups as remote as Hawaii, making the black-crowned night heron the most widespread heron on Earth. Such a far-flung range suggests highly successful adaptation. Feeding at night, black-crowned night herons are freed from competing with the more numerous day-hunting herons. They're also very opportunistic feeders. While fish are often primary prey, the herons will consume everything from earthworms to clams to eggs of nesting birds and refuse at landfills. They also have a flexibly long breeding season, which may enable them to thrive across such a broad geographic range. Since they are high on the food chain, found over much of the world, and nest in colonies, black-crowned night herons can tell us a great deal about the health or contamination of our environment. Today's show was produced with support from the Bird Note Pacific Flyway Circle. Thank you, donors, for your generous support.
And you're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Monday, October 6, 2014. Scott Burton, your host. And now in the studio with me are Louise Miller. Welcome to the show, Louise.
Thank you.
Nice to have you. And her daughter, Jessie Snyder. Nice
Hello.
To see you, too.
Thank you.
Yeah, welcome to the class. So you both are painters and teachers, is that right?
We are. We've both been doing art all of our lives, practically. Uh-huh. And recently, within this half a year, we decided to offer painting classes.
Painting okay. parties.
Painting parties.
Yeah. They're different. You do learn skills and techniques, but it's more about having fun. It's a social engagement as opposed to a class where the teacher is wagging their finger at you.
Oh, wow. So sort of for the listeners, describe what one looks like.
Well, one looks like my studio, which is the loft in our garage.
Okay.
It's a small space. We have room for eight
okay.
painters at a time. We supply the canvas and the paint and the brushes and the instruction, and we all work on the same image.
Interesting.
At that time. Yeah, and it's always amazes me how wonderfully a creative the people come, and they're all thrilled with the pieces they go home. They show up and they say, I can't do this, I don't know the first thing about this, and then they leave 3 hours later with something like, wow, I didn't know I could do that. So it's been a lot of fun.
And I noticed on your website you talk about how you prefer to work in oil, but in these classes you'll often use acrylics.
We only use acrylics in the classes because acrylics dry fast.
Sure.
They have a lot of the same kind of blending properties as oil do, except oils take weeks to dry. Acrylics, somebody can walk out with their paint, or they do walk out with their painting that evening.
Okay. And Jesse, have you grown up learning how to paint from your mom?
Not really. I did beading and other creative things. Several years ago, mom got back into painting, and I was amazed. She was watching Bob Ross videos.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm like, Mom, can I have a class? So we sat down with a Bob Ross video, and even though he does his in 30 minutes, we took an hour and a half, and
uh-huh.
I got a painting and that I was quite happy with. And so then I sort of developed from there. I have two young children right now. My oldest is 6 and my youngest is 3, so I don't have the time to develop the skill and the paintings like my mom does. So I primarily do the big little classes, and those are classes for an adult and a child that they both paint the same image and have the same amount of fun. But the images are simpler, more basic.
Okay.
That even a 5-year-old can do.
And Louise, when did you start painting? Tell us about that.
I started painting in high school. It's
okay.
how I got through school. I was not a very scholarly person, but music and art got me through school. So I have some paintings that I did when I was in high school, and then did a few more, and then kind of dropped it when my children were little, just because of time.
Sure.
And then took, you know, here and there I would do some. And then about 15 years ago, I got into painting with oils again and fell in love with the medium. I just really like the way you can work an oil painting.
Sure. And speaking of getting you through high school, what does painting do for you?
It just makes me happy.
Yeah.
It puts me in a happy place. I get up, I'm retired. My husband and I are retired now, and I get up, have my breakfast, and I'm out in my studio, and I paint for several hours and then visit with my grandbabies, and then I might go back and paint a little bit more, but
Wow, that sounds like a good life.
It is. It's lovely. It's wonderful.
That's great. And what inspired you to start teaching? I guess it sort of just made sense if it makes you happy.
I
you
had,
doing it.
Yeah, it makes me happy. But I had, teach painting. It's a lot of fun to paint with other people.
Mm-hmm.
And I've painted with my daughter, and I have painted with some friends in the past, and they have really enjoyed themselves. So a very good friend of ours who traveled came back, just, you know what they're doing down south? They're having these painting parties. And I said, that sounds like fun. So it was her suggestion, and we just kind of ran with it. And they have been very well received. So,
great.
Yeah.
And so these happen, you live in the valley, is that correct?
I do live in the valley.
Okay, so maybe off I was looking at the map on the website.
It's off Dredge Lake Road.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And you can probably find a map there. But before we get to the exact location, tell us about some of the classes you have coming up.
Well,
On Wednesday, we have an image of a fence. It's a cutout of a fence of a heart, and then through the fence you can see a field. And that one will be painted by me.
Okay.
And then I'm going to Seattle, and Mom has a couple of classes.
Yes, on Friday we have a party, but it's full, which I love to say. Saturday we have another one, which is not full yet, and it's using a different technique. We're using a palette knife, so it'll be mostly a palette knife technique for that class.
Okay.
Anyone can do it. I mean, these are all beginner classes.
Okay.
And then the following week we have four classes coming up, four parties. The one on Tuesday is a silhouette of an owl in a tree, kind of Halloween-y, you know, mm-hmm. kind of dark. And then Jesse has one on Wednesday, which is some birds silhouetted on a tree. On Friday, there's no school on Friday.
Okay.
So Friday in the afternoon, there's another Halloween one for the big littles.
It's a little cat on a pumpkin.
Fun.
And then Saturday on the 18th is another adult one in the evening, and that's another fall tree one. So we have lots of opportunities to get together and have fun.
Absolutely. And just going back a second to you said anybody can take these classes
mm-hmm.
at any level.
The evening ones, we say they need to be, is it 21 is the drinking age? We say you could be a BYOB.
Okay.
So I know if you're under age, then you have to have an adult with you.
Okay.
So they can come.
Yeah, yeah.
But the big littles are over 5.
Okay.
5 and up.
For the most part, there we do have one big little that requires a little more attention and detail, so my 6-year-old daughter can't do it. So,
okay.
But it will say what age level all of the classes are. So but for the most part, the big littles are for 5 and up, and then the adult classes are mostly all beginner. We have one intermediate class. It's a old wheel with some fireweed that is going to be at the end of the month, but that's an intermediate level with the little advanced shadings and whatnot.
Okay. Where should folks go if they want to learn more about all this?
They can go to our website, which is Louise Miller Fine Art, all one word, .blogspot.com.
Okay. And if you forget that, I when I put in your name, Louise Miller, Juno Art, it took me right there.
Oh,
I found
cool.
it in a search. So.
Good to know.
And, you know, I found the calendar there, and I could see all the classes coming up and the descriptions and all that. So that would be a good resource for folks. Louise or Jesse, anything else that you would like to add?
Well, we'd love to see you out there.
Oh, sounds like fun. Is that drink a little wine, maybe?
Yeah, drink a little wine. We provide the cups and the plates. You can bring a snack if you like, so
uh-huh.
You know, you can just take care of your drinking and eating eating necessities as you need. And we do. We provide the canvas and the paint and the brushes and all the instruction.
And how much does it cost for a person to enter?
The evening parties are $25 a person. And the big littles are $40 for the couple,
okay.
for the pair. And we have 100% guarantee. If you don't have fun and you don't enjoy your painting at the end, the next session's free.
Great.
We are that certain.
All right, Louise Miller and Jesse Snyder, thanks to you both for coming in today.
Thank you very much.
Nice talking to you. You're welcome. Thanks for listening to A Juno Afternoon here on Monday, October 6th, 2014. Tomorrow on A Juno Afternoon, Ken Fix will be here, and we'll talk with Cheryl McRoberts about next month's second annual Bald Eagle Festival in Haines. Actually, it's probably more than the second one, but I don't have that here. I can't remember what it was. Dave Pusich will highlight the CBJ Adult and Youth Sports Program. We'll talk with Deborah Corker about this Saturday's Alaska Health Fair, plus Writer's Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more Tuesday at 3 on KTOO. If you missed A Juno Afternoon or want to hear it again, you can find it in the local programs link on our homepage, www.ktoo.org. Tune in beginning at 8 for live coverage of Tuesday's municipal election tomorrow. It's currently 45 degrees at the federal building. And the weather tonight, numerous rain showers, patchy fog late, lows around 37. Tuesday, patchy fog in the morning, numerous rain showers, highs around 44. Wednesday, mostly cloudy, slight chance of rain, highs around 47. Thursday, rain, highs around 49. Lows around 39.
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. We rebroadcast on translators K276 AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269 AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K201 AM in Gustavus, K220 BT in Hoonah, and K210 AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, KTOO is on GCI Cable, on digital channel 871. We're also online at ktoo.org. Support for national programming on KTOO comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Stay tuned for All Things Considered in about 30 seconds.